Well, good morning. We are about halfway through our Hope Rising series that we started back at Easter. And this morning, the title of the message is When Facing It Alone. And it can be a lot of things, but this morning gave us the opportunity to talk about a topic we don't normally address, and that is singleness. If you remember a few months ago, we did a series called Reclaiming Marriage. And at the time, we told single folks, if you're not married, there's going to be a little bit of a disconnect, but we ask that you stick with us because maybe someday you will be married, or there's opportunities for people that you may know to connect with this information. So maybe you can be the vessel through which they connect with this information. And so this morning, because as a teaching team, we know it's difficult to be a single person, sitting out in the audience going, this doesn't speak to me. This morning, we have the opportunity to say something to single people that speaks mostly to them. But if you are a married person, we ask that you don't check out, much for the same reason that we asked single people not to check out when we were doing our marriage series. And that is because, number one, you may someday find yourself single. The statistics will tell us that 49% of all adults are currently single in one way or another. And it may be that in the future, this information will be helpful to you. It may also be that you may not be part of that 49%, but someone that you know and that you care about, someone in your life, someone that you are close to, is single, and something that'll be said this morning may be exactly what they need to hear, and you may be the vessel through which they may have that opportunity to hear it. And it may be that as you listen to the message, you say, you know what, I know somebody at work. I know somebody who lives down the street. I know somebody that we do life with, and they would greatly benefit from hearing this message. So you may have the opportunity to direct them towards the website and the media page and the opportunity to listen to the sermon or to view the sermon online. And that may be an opportunity for them to be exposed to the gospel and to hear the good news of Jesus Christ spoken directly to their situation. So this morning, it is it's my opportunity. This is honestly a little bit of a difficult difficult sermon, because I have not been single for 14 years. I've been married for 14 years, so it's been 14 years since I've been single. And even then, I was 20. I was young when I got married. And so there was a very small window between leaving mom and dad's house and then moving into my first apartment with my wife, in which I could say I was single and I had all of these single experiences to draw from. So a good portion of what I did this week was contacting people in my life that are single and picking their brain and asking questions and finding out what their experience was like. And one of the things that I discovered in talking to them is that by and large, this world does not seem to be built for one. It's built for two. It's pretty easy to see that that's one of the challenges. By and large, our culture is built for two. Christy and I were on vacation recently, and all of our accommodations were based on double occupancy. And that worked great for us. There were two of us. We were going to, you know, be in a hotel room together. That worked. But if I showed up as a single person, those rates were still based on double occupancy. I don't know if that means you're supposed to go out to the street and just say, hey, you want to and share a hotel room with some stranger and split the price? I don't know. Have we ever heard of someone winning an all-expenses-paid trip for one? Have you ever tried to go to a restaurant by yourself and be seated for one? It's hard. You get put on this special list. I've done it before. They have the list of normal accommodations, and then they have like the single person list that they pull out of some bin and they scrape the dust off of, and they look at you strange as they write your name down. You're like, are you sure? You sure? We could put you with this other table of two. They'll be happy to accommodate an extra friend, but really, table for one? Our world, by and large, is built for two, and because that's the case, because like coupling is identified as the norm, sometimes being single is dismissed or addressed. We can feel invisible. One of my friends described it as being single in a world built for two can make you feel like you're a square peg in a culture full of round holes. And so too often, singleness goes unaddressed, it goes missed out. So this morning, we have the opportunity to speak specifically within this Hope Rising series to what do you do when you're facing life alone as a single person? First off, being single offers unique challenges and opportunities. I don't want to spend the entire morning telling you how horrible being single can be, because what I've discovered is that being single has challenges, but it also has unique opportunities that those of us who are in a relationship and are married and are a couple may miss out on and may have forgotten that we even experienced as single people. This morning, we're going to explore the book of Ruth. The book of Ruth is an incredible book. Not only is it a pretty quick and easy read at just four chapters, in there is such a wealth of ideas of the way that God works and the way that God moves and the way that God deals with people. And my encouragement would be everybody this week, find a block of time. I read through Ruth multiple times this week. I can't say it ever took me more than about 20 minutes to read through the book in its entirety. But find a 20 minutes, find a half hour to sit down with God's word and read it and to discover the incredible, powerful things, because we're going to kind of do a Cliff's Notes version of Ruth. We're not going to be able to hit every idea or every theme that's in there, but as you read it, to be reminded of the incredible, powerful things and the incredibly powerful way that God moves in his people. But anyways, Ruth is a unique book. Ruth is a unique book in that all of the lead characters in the book of Ruth are single. And single is a broad category. It's a broad category of people. And as we explore these three characters, we'll see that they each come to the story with a unique set of circumstances that put them in kind of a different place than all of the other characters in the book. So let's dive right in. In the first chapter of Ruth, we're introduced to Naomi. Right from the get-go, we're introduced to Naomi, and Naomi is an older widow. Naomi has moved with her husband away from Jerusalem to Moab. She's living as a foreigner amongst the Moabites, where her two younger sons each find a wife, and then Naomi's husband doesn't say why, but he passes away. And so she now finds herself a widow. And for 12 years, she remains in the household of her sons, continuing to live in Moab until their untimely death. And now, Naomi has lost her husband, she's lost her sons, and she is a stranger in a foreign land. She makes the decision that she is going to return to her people. She's going to go home because there is nothing left for her in that place, in that land. And so in Ruth chapter 1, verses 20 and 21, we get a little bit of an idea. We get a peek into her mindset. And this is what she says. She has returned to Jerusalem. She's greeted and welcomed by the women of the town who recognize her and say, "Is this not Naomi who we have missed for all these years?" And here's her response. She says, "Don't call me Naomi," which in the Hebrew, that word means pleasant. "Don't call me Naomi," she told them. "Call me Mara," which again in the Hebrew means bitter, "because the Almighty has made my life very bitter." Then later in 21, Naomi says, "I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty." And so we get this picture of this woman who's like many singles, single people, those whose life circumstances find them single really with no other option. And so the dominant characteristic that Naomi reveals about herself, at least at the beginning, is this sense of loneliness. Loneliness, which may not be unique to single people, but certainly perhaps more prevalent among single people, is the opportunity to feel alone is there just a little bit more. As I was preparing, I thought about my grandmother, who after 64 years of marriage, had to watch her husband passed away, and then for the last 6 years has been doing life as an older widow. And so I spent some time on the phone with her talking about what her experience has been like. And to be quite honest, there was a lot of loneliness that she referenced, a lot of loneliness that she talked about. Here's kind of idea some of the things she said. She said, the first thing that she discovered after my grandfather passed away was that there was nobody to tell her, hey, it's time to go to bed, let's go to bed. And there was nobody to wake her up if she happened to fall asleep in front of the TV at night. And so I said, you know, there were months where I would be watching TV and I'd just wake up the next morning. The bed never got unmade because I never made it to bed. And it was an adjustment and getting used to the idea that there's nobody there to say, hey, it's time to go to bed. And she really had to adjust to that new reality. She said, one of the difficult things even now is spending time with other people, knowing that once you leave, that conversation is over. And that social time is over because there's nobody to go back with you, to go home, to continue that and to carry it on. When you get home, there's nobody waiting for you. And you are, after all, alone. She said managing the household responsibilities without someone to share the workload with was a difficult adjustment. And I kind of empathized with that because I realized if I suddenly was to find myself single and alone, more than likely, this is exactly what you would see me in every day for weeks and weeks, and it would gradually start to smell bad and look bad because I know where the washer and dryer is, and I consider that a victory. Like, I know where they're located in my house, and that should be enough. But if I was single, there would be a whole world of chores and household responsibilities that I'm just not prepared to do. And my wife, who's running the slides, is upstairs shaking her head like, you have no idea how good you have it, buddy. And she's right. And then finally, the last thing that my grandmother mentioned was being sick and not having someone there to make a cup of soup or to do some of those things that when you're sick, you just don't feel up to doing. That you're on your own. And that it can feel, at times, lonely. And here's the thing, loneliness can strike all of us. I've always believed that married people can be just as lonely as single people, and that it's possible to feel completely alone and to feel tremendous, crushing loneliness surrounded by a group of people. However, for single people, loneliness is a unique and sometimes more prevalent challenge. All right, but it's not just Naomi we meet. We also meet Ruth, the younger widow. Ruth is the foreign daughter-in-law to one of Naomi's sons, who suddenly in life faces a crisis because her husband has passed away. And so now she's confronted by this new, unique circumstance. Naomi tells both of her daughter-in-laws, go back home, go back to your parents' household, go back to your people, go back to the life that you've known, because Naomi is going home. And she says, there's nothing for you there. You'll be in the situation I am. You'll be a foreigner without a husband to care for you in a foreign land. And here's what we discover about Ruth. Ruth chapter 1, verses 16 and 17 has this beautiful statement of loyalty. As Ruth says, amongst other things, where you go, I will go. She proclaims to her mother-in-law, I'm in, I'm with you. Wherever you're going, that's where I'll be. She says, your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. Where you lay down, I will lie down. She makes this statement of loyalty. And whereas her sister-in-law goes back to her people, Ruth begins an adventure. See, that's one of the things about being single, is you have the opportunity for adventure. And you may miss out on it. You may not even notice it. But Ruth is uniquely positioned now because she is no longer tied to a spouse. She doesn't have any children, where she's available for adventure. Reminds me of some of the students that I've had in youth ministry that are now adults who haven't yet settled down. Some of the opportunities that they have, some of the things that they can do, I sometimes look at and go, man, I remember that. That was fun. That was cool. I enjoyed that. Like, for instance, every now and then one of them will pop on to Facebook in like a Thursday afternoon, and they'll send out a quick message like, hey, I'm thinking about going to whatever movie it is that's premiering that night and going to the midnight show. Who's in? Who wants to go? And oftentimes I think like, hey, that would be fun. I should do that, until I remember that going to a midnight opening as a married person, as a person with young children, that requires like 3 weeks of advanced planning, right? Like, you've got to start adjusting your sleep pattern weeks in advance to be prepared for a movie that starts at midnight and goes into, you know, like 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, because the kids will still be there at 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning, poking your face and asking if you can get them juice. Still there. But for my single friends, they don't have that hindrance. They're available for adventure. It reminds me, and in fact, I got a hold of one of my students who I stay in contact with. It reminds me of probably a couple years ago now, where I got a text message from him that says, hey man, thinking about going to the Grand Canyon for a week, want to come along? And so I texted him back, like, when are you thinking about doing this? Tomorrow. Like, what? Are you kidding me? Like, if I came home to the house and said, hey, I'm going to the Grand Canyon tomorrow for a week, have fun, I would be single again. And so a few minutes later, I kind of text him out, like, dude, that sounds like fun, but there's no way I'd be able to do that. And so all of a sudden, up pops on Facebook, like, thinking about going to the Grand Canyon for a week, who wants to come along? And then I think as a result of my text, I'm like, by the way, leaving tomorrow. And then about 15 minutes later, anybody have a bigger car so that we can all ride in one vehicle? He had found five of his buddies who all wanted to go to the Grand Canyon, and they were available to just drop everything and leave the next day. That's an adventure. That's an availability that, as a married person, I don't have. But some of these single friends of mine have that opportunity, have that availability to go on an adventure, just drop everything, to tell work, hey, I'll be back in a week, and to go and to do. And Ruth kind of exudes some of that. She's available for an adventure that if she was tied down, she would be unavailable for otherwise. So we've got a third character that we meet. This is Boaz. Boaz, who, you know, for the sake of our time together this morning, I'm just referring to as our godly bachelor. He's the godly bachelor. Chapter 2, we get this really awesome introduction to Boaz by way of just, he enters the store and he starts interacting. He starts interacting with Ruth. His character is revealed to be that of a godly man who, upon discovering who Ruth is, sets out to protect her, sets out to care for her above and beyond the provision that God's law has already put in place for her to be cared for. See, we meet Boaz when Ruth goes out into his field to glean from his harvest. See, we've got to give that a little context. God's law provided for the poor, the widows, the orphans, those who didn't have a means to care for themselves, by telling landowners that you could harvest the field once. You could basically go through, and what you got on the first time through, that's what you got, and the rest needed to be left for the poor, for the widowed, for the orphan, so that they could be provided for from the land when they had no other means. And so Ruth, as a widow, goes out into the field, and by luck, by fate, by fortune, by whatever you want to chalk it up to, she finds herself in Boaz's field. And Boaz is returning from town and is available to spend time looking through the field. Normally, landowners are occupied with the things of their household, and so they leave the fields to the servants. They leave them to the foreman that they've provided for. But Boaz is available. As he's standing out there, he sees Ruth, who is out gleaning. She's following behind the servants, and she's taking what's been left behind. And he asks his servants, who is this? And they explain to him. They explain to him what Ruth has done in caring for Naomi and traveling with Naomi from a foreign land, in now being her caretaker, so to speak, and in following behind the harvest and gleaning to provide for Naomi and for herself. And Boaz is struck by this, so much so that at lunchtime, as the break comes, he calls her over and he says this. He says, I've been told all about what you have done for your mother-in-law. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. And then as she returns to the field, he quietly pulls his servants aside and he says, okay, look, not only are we going to make sure she's taken care of, but I want to go above and beyond that. I want to be generous. And so see to it that every now and then as you're harvesting, you accidentally leave something behind for her. And that you make sure that she's taken care of. Don't embarrass her. Don't run her off. Let her harvest behind you and treat her just like you would treat one of the servant girls in the field. And so at the end of the day, Ruth is able to take away from the harvest basically a day's worth of provision, just like she would have received if she was a servant. She received an equal portion and not the small little bit of scraps that would have been expected for someone who had just been gleaning. She did really well for herself that day. And so what we discover about Boaz is like those whose life circumstances make them uniquely capable of going above and beyond. They have an added availability on top of what everybody else starts with. And we don't get a whole lot of background, we don't get a whole lot of information about Boaz, but we find him out in his fields when most landowners would be away. We find him staying out with the servants and sleeping by the threshing floors when most landowners would have gone home to the obligations and the responsibilities that they had back at home. So Boaz is uniquely available. Reminded me of one of my aunts who also is a widow, but entered being a widow earlier in life. She had for many years, cared for my uncle, who for the last 10 years of his life had been sickly, had been unable to care for himself. And so she was very much a caretaker for 10 years, her life occupied with either work or caring for him. And as unfortunate as it was that he passed away, it opened up an availability for her that she hadn't had. She said one of the things that she discovered right from the beginning is that she had to make a conscious choice to separate work and rediscovering life. Said it would have been really easy to just crawl into becoming a workaholic and taking those extra available hours that would have been spent at home with a spouse and just pouring them into work. But she said, instead, I did the very healthy thing, and I went and discovered and refound my life. And so for her, a big part of that was traveling. She said it started with reevaluating what she could do, what she was financially or physically capable of, what she wanted to do, and then what she was comfortable doing. Talks about one of the great leaps there being she decided that one of the things she wanted to do was to travel to 5 specific cities in the United States. And she said the first one, it was very difficult, but the first one she wanted to do alone. She didn't want a traveling companion. When her friends heard about it, knowing that she was a new widow, they said, no, you can't go alone. You can't go alone. You need somebody to go with you because there's no way you could survive or you could get by or you could get around being alone. And she said, it was incredibly important to me that I had the opportunity to do it by myself, to find out what I was capable of, what my limits are, how far I could go. Feeling out and testing those limits was radically important. She said, once I knew what I could do on my own, it became easy and it became fun to do things with other people. And then she said, you know what? I really wish that when it comes time to fill a form out and you have those 2 checkboxes, she made the joke, you know, you've got like 20 checkboxes for ethnicity, but only 2 for marital status. You're either married or you're single. And she said, you know, I really wish there was a third box that was independent. She said, I don't think of myself necessarily as a single person. I don't necessarily think of myself as a married person. I've kind of lived in both worlds. And I'm at the point in my life where I just think of myself as an independent person who's been given the opportunity and the gift of having more available time than many of my friends who are in relationships, who are married. And so Ruth's willingness to pursue the adventure that was behind her and Boaz's availability frame the rest of the story in the book of Ruth. So like I said, we're going to get through the rest of the book in kind of a Cliff's Note version. You guys know Cliff's Note, right? So you've got a book that you're assigned to read in school, and it's a day before the report's due or the test is coming, and you haven't started reading the book. And so you go to the bookstore or the library, and you find the little yellow version that's only like 18 pages. Some of you guys are nodding. You know what I'm talking about. And Cliff's Notes got you through high school. That's okay. That's okay. Me too. All right. So here we go. We pick up at the end of chapter 2. Naomi gets the report back from Ruth on what has transpired, on what has happened. And Naomi begins to put some things in place. Some things become clear to her in her mind. And she gives Ruth instructions that seem odd to us, that seem strange to us. She says, go and lay down at Boaz's feet. He's spending the night out with his men at the harvest, go out and lay down at his feet. When he wakes up, ask that he would take the edge of his cloak and just lay it over you. Now, I'm sure Ruth is going like, that sounds weird, but okay. She goes along with it. And Boaz does wake up, and Ruth says, will you spend it? And he does and responds. And here's what Naomi has put into place. She understood within Hebrew law that there was this provision made for widows. And what it was this idea of what's referred to as a goel in Hebrew. But it's a family guardian or redeemer. It's the person who's responsible for caring for the family when an orphan or a widow is left behind and they've got property, but they can't afford to manage it. The idea was that the person left behind would sell the property to the goel. The goel would then purchase it, not just for himself, but for the family, and return the property to its original owner. So the person who's widowed or orphaned now has the proceeds of the sale, but the land is returned to them, and they can continue to receive the annual harvest from the land. And this was the role and the opportunity. It wasn't a responsibility. It was the opportunity for the goel or for the redeemer to come in and to say, I'm going to make your situation better. I'm going to care for you. We're going to see that land continues to be in your hands and you will be okay. And so we discover that Boaz is one of these goels, these family redeemers for Naomi. And so she sends Ruth to him, asking basically, will you be our family's redeemer? And he responds, he says, yes, I will be your redeemer. But then, being a godly man, he says, but there is someone closer. There's someone closer in relation who has the first responsibility and first opportunity to be the redeemer. Before I can be the redeemer, I must ask him if he's willing to be. And if he's willing to be, it's right for him to do so. And so they go to him the next day, and there's this interaction. They ask, will you be the redeemer? He says, at first, yes, I will be the redeemer. And then Boaz says, okay, but here's the thing. If you're going to be the redeemer, you also have to take Ruth, the Moabite woman, as your wife. And suddenly he backs off. He says, I can't do that. And what he says, I can't do that because, number one, I can't risk my family's fortune that we're going to be paying out for the land, but then also I'm going to have to divide my inheritance amongst any children that Ruth would have and my own children. And I think, if it was me, in the back of his head, he's also thinking, and there's no way my wife is going for this. I'm not like, hey, honey, I bought some land, and they threw this in for free. I don't think that's going to work for him. I think he understands that. And so he declines. But because of Boaz's availability, he's able to say, not only can I do it, I will do it. And he takes Ruth as his wife, he redeems the land, and then, you would think that wraps up the story, but it doesn't. We get a couple of footnotes. The first footnote we get is that Ruth and Boaz, they have a child. They have a child together, and they name him Obed. And in chapter 4, verses 15 through 17, we get Naomi, who had been lonely. Remember, she comes back to Jerusalem and says, I'm childless. God has taken everything away from me. And we get this picture of her holding her grandson. And the women of the town gather around, and they say, look at Naomi. She has a child. And God redeems her. God wraps up her story. She's no longer lonely. She's living with Boaz and Ruth, and she's raising a child. She's caregiver to Obed, her grandson. Then we get a second footnote. It says that Obed was the father of, make sure I get this right, Jesse, who was the father of David, King David. See, this story, this little book stuck between Judges and 1 Samuel tells us the story of how three single people had an interaction, came together to have a place in Jesus' lineage, to have a place in the lineage of King David, who would have a place in the lineage of Jesus, and that God was at work in this. And so there's a few things that we can recognize as we begin to wrap up this time together. It's first that God's plans have a place for single people. God's plans have a place for single people. Obed, the son of Jesse, the son of David, doesn't come into the picture if not for three single people: Naomi, Ruth, and Boaz. If not for Naomi being single, she never leaves Moab. If not for Ruth being single, and we know this because there was a 12-year time span between when Naomi became single and when Ruth became single. If not for Ruth also becoming single, there is no Obed or Jesse or David. God has a place. If not for Ruth being willing to go on an adventure now as a newly single person, there is no story. And if not for Boaz being available to say, I will redeem and I will take Ruth as my wife, there is no story. God's plans have a place for single people. Secondly, watching Naomi's story from beginning to end is that God offers relief for our loneliness. In fact, I think if you look at the story on a whole, Naomi, although she has a season of loneliness, she's never really lonely. Because even when everything is taken away from her, her daughter-in-law remains close to her, promises her loyalty, and stays with her. That God has provided, in the amazing ways that he does, a cure for our loneliness. And it's other people. It may not be the spouse that we necessarily want or picture, but none of us are without a community. And the amazing thing is that Jesus, in his time on earth, established this thing called the church, so that in it, even the most lonely of people can say, I have a family. I have brothers and sisters who stand by me and who walk with me. And even as I might experience times of loneliness, I am never alone. So this is my moment to plug and to encourage you, if you're not in a life group, connect with a life group. What better way than to have a regular meeting and a regular gathering in which you can sit with people and say, here is where I'm at in my life. Here's what's going on. And they can respond to you and say, you don't walk through that alone. We're with you. We've experienced the same thing. We've gone to the same journeys. And we are with you to support you, to encourage you, to help prop you up when you feel weak. That's what community is about. And that's why community is so vital and so important for the Christ follower. And then third and finally, in Christ, we have all that we need to be content. You know, it's amazing how much an attitude can change the experience we have of a situation. The last week and a half, I was away on vacation. We took a cruise up to Vancouver, and one of the stops there was Victoria, Canada. Now, if you know anything about Victoria, Canada, there are two things in Victoria: really old buildings and really big gardens. And neither of those seem at all interesting to me. And so right from the get-go, as we kind of booked this itinerary, I recognized that that was going to be the struggle on our vacation, was to find a way to make that day enjoyable. And it so happened that my wife found a really old, fancy hotel that did a high tea. And she'd always wanted to participate in one. She always wanted to do one. So she booked two spots at the very swanky, very ritzy high tea that I had absolutely no interest in, because first off, I don't drink tea. And from what I understand and now know from experience, that's a pretty large component of tea, is the drinking of it. And so kind of right from the get, as we're planning this trip, I knew that I had two ways that I could respond. I could just become incredibly bitter and difficult and moan and whine about it the entire time leading up to it and talk about how much I don't want to do it and how I'm going to hate it and how it's going to be miserable. Or I could find a way to enjoy it, to just be content, to know that it's something special, it's something we're only doing once in our life, and I'm sticking by that. We've already done it. Don't have to do it again. But it was going to be a pleasant experience, because I was going to choose to make it a pleasant experience. I was going to be content. And so the day came, we pulled into port. I was feeling incredibly sick. I had developed a head cold and a chest infection on the boat. And so I woke up feeling miserable. And just adding to, there's a city that I don't care about, and we're having tea in a building that I don't care about, and I don't want to do tea to start with, and now I don't feel good. And if you know me at all, I don't do sick well. I just lay around and whine and hack up stuff and moan. It's bad. But I decided at the get-go that I was going to get the most out of and enjoy the opportunity as much as I can. And to be quite honest, we went through the day, and we had a wonderful day. We had a pleasant day. I was sick. I was miserable. I didn't feel good. I was pumping Canadian pharmacies are really cool, if you ever get, anyways. I was taking everything that they could legally give me so that I would feel better. And we had a nice time. I'd even say we had a good time. I'd even say I enjoyed high tea at the Empress. It was not miserable, because I chose to be content. And isn't that true of so many of life's circumstances? They are what we make of them. There have been plenty of times that there has been something I haven't wanted to do, and I've ruined it, no matter how good it could have been, because I decided from the get-go that I was going to be miserable. And the number of times that experiences that could have been miserable were enjoyable or at least tolerable, because I found contentment. And so the great threat is missing what God has in store for us, because we choose not to be content, because we choose to focus on the difficulty of our circumstances rather than finding contentment in them. Philippians chapter 4:13 often gets misquoted. Like, we all know, maybe not by heart, but when we hear it, it resonates with us, where Paul says, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me, and we miss out on the context of it. And so sometimes it frustrates me, because, I'll be watching boxing or something. I remember Evander Holyfield, and he had Philippians 4:13. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. On there, as though it meant, it doesn't matter what the fight is, I'm going to win because Jesus is in my corner. Or the times where somebody is going on this incredibly impossible adventure, and they say, hey, do you think you're going to be able to do it? I go, oh, yeah, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. And they go off to the North Pole or whatever crazy thing they've dreamed up. And they miss the context of what Paul's saying. Here it is in its entirety when you read it together with the verses preceding it, 12 and 13. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. I can do all things through him who gives me strength. Paul's saying the strength that we tap in through Christ, it's to be able to overcome the situations of our lives that we've been placed with, because we accept them with contentment. That's the promise. That's the power. It's not Superman Herculean strength to overcome any odds. It's in those moments in life where you seem like you just cannot be content or satisfied. God, who goes before you, gives you the strength to be content and satisfied. Whether it's loneliness or heartbreak or poverty or disappointment, God gives us what we need to be content. He gives us the strength to find contentment no matter what our circumstances. The strength to find contentment in your situation, no matter what it is, because the God who loved us and created us says in Hebrews chapter 3, verse 5, I will never leave you, nor will I forsake you. And so this morning, no matter where you're at, no matter what you're struggling with, whether it's the loneliness of being single, whether it's the frustrations of being disappointed by the way life is gone, throughout our entire Hope Rising series, every topic we talk about, Philippians 4:13 continues to speak to it. No matter what our situation, we can have contentment in where we are because of Jesus Christ, who gives us strength. Will you stand with me? In a moment, there'll be leaders up here. And if this morning you have been looking everywhere for contentment, have yet to find it, we offer it to you in the person of Jesus. Place your faith and your hope and your trust in him. And believe Paul's promise that he will provide for you the strength that you need to be content. Maybe you're just at a place in your journey where you are beaten up and you are exhausted, and you just need somebody to speak with, somebody to pray with, somebody to encourage you to say you are not going through it alone, and God will never leave you. He'll never forsake you. He'll never let you go. He will continue to give you what you need so this too you can overcome. Then come down and speak with someone at the conclusion of the service. Will you pray with me? Heavenly Father, this morning we thank you for all that you do for us. Now this morning we thank you for the reminder that we see in this little book of Ruth, that you have a very specific and special plan for all of us. And that even includes single people, includes forgotten people, lonely people, broken people. But God, thank you for the reminder that you work through all of us and you work in all of us and you have a plan for us. God, whatever the part we are to play in your plan, we just ask that you would give us the strength and the courage to face every day. That you would give us the hope necessary to believe and to trust that you are going to walk before us, that you are going to provide for us. God, help us in every way to honor and glorify you in our lives. I thank you for your word. I thank you for the opportunity I have to share it. I pray for Jeremy as he is recovering, that you will continue to walk in that recovery and aid him and heal him so that he can be back up here sharing with us in the coming weeks. God, thank you for all that you're doing in this community. It is good to be part of your work. In Jesus' name, amen.